Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Selling Greenville, your favorite real estate podcast here in lovely Greenville, South Carolina. I'm your host, as always, Stan McCune, realtor right here in the Greenville area of South Carolina. Well, I'm in Greenville proper. I used to be in Greer. I bounced around a few different places, but I'm in Greenville, right near Midtown Greenville, in case you're really wondering. And you can find all of my contact information, as always, in the show notes if you need to reach out to me for any of your local real estate needs. And just a reminder, as always, please like, rate, review, subscribe. Don't miss any future episodes. I've got this podcast on a lot of platforms. I actually just added a few platforms, which, by the way, one of those was YouTube, okay? Now, I've been doing video on YouTube for over a year, but they recently added a whole podcast thing where you can actually have a podcast feed to YouTube. I'm still figuring out exactly what that means, but I've gotten some questions because the audio and the video are separated out on my Selling Greenville Pod YouTube channel. So just keep that in mind. There's going to be, until I can figure out how to not have it this way, there's going to be an audio version and a video version on YouTube on the same channel. I apologize for that. That's a YouTube quirk. That's not something I can control. Since I added this to YouTube as audio, as part of a stream the past week, holy cow, a whole lot more interest in the podcast. Some good questions that have come through on YouTube, and I appreciate those. I try to respond to every single good question that I get on YouTube that's not, you know, some scammer or spammer or troll or whatever the case may be. So thank you guys for watching and for listening, please make sure you subscribe. And if you can support the show by leaving a rating or a review or a like or whatever the case may be, I would greatly appreciate that. All right. I'm going to be kind of winging this episode, but not because, I just like to wing things. I actually like to really prepare these episodes out. But I feel like we are kind of at a point, and I've talked about this a few different times on a few different episodes, but I feel like we really need to kind of take a step back, right? I can get, particularly me and some of my listeners, if you're real estate investors, you can get really, really close to the market, so close that you kind of miss the forest for the trees. And you know, as we're taking things day by day, it's easy to lose track of what's happening month by month and year by year. Even when I go through the market stats that come out that the Greater Greenville Association of Realtors produces each and every month, it is still very easy for me to lose track of like what's actually happening. And so sometimes it's helpful to just take a step back, take a deep breath and say, okay, how is the market like genuinely different than the way it's been in the past? And I get a lot of questions from people specifically about this, and I want to address those questions. We're not going to rehash market stats, okay? That'll probably be next week's episode where we go over the month's market stats. We don't have them yet. I'm recording this on May 20th. GJR has not produced those yet for the month of April, so I'm still waiting on those. But I'm just going to talk about what I am personally seeing as a realtor, and I think you guys will find it interesting. All right, for starters, all right, we're just going to start at the top. Creative negotiation is back, okay? We went through a stretch where there really wasn't a whole lot of creative negotiations, right? If when it's an extreme market, whether an extreme seller's market or an extreme buyer's market, there isn't a whole lot of creative negotiation that happens because one of the two parties holds all the cards, basically. They have all the leverage, and so they basically dictate where the negotiation goes. Well, as the market has kind of, you know, shifted and kind of settled and kind of, you know, become what it is, I'm really starting to see, really the past 6 months, you want to go back a little bit further, probably the past 12 months, but really in particular the past few months, creative negotiation. Here's something I really love, okay? That's actually getting in the weeds of negotiating with other realtors, because it really is a game. And if you guys know me well, you know I love games, And I was actually playing a game with my church small group recently that was all about having a poker face, and I kept getting, so it was a game where you could kind of be like it, right? Where there was like one card that was like the bad guy, but you had to pretend like you weren't the bad guy, and then the rest of the group would vote on who they thought the bad guy was based on a variety of answers. And I kept winning, even though I kept getting that one card that was a bad guy, and it was all about my poker face. I'm not trying to brag about my poker face, but that is a bigger element than you think in real estate negotiating. There is actual bluffing in real estate negotiation, and it happens quite a bit. And I've got two examples from just recently. So I had a listing where we got an offer that was below list price, and the home hadn't been on the market that long. It really didn't make sense for the seller to accept the offer, and the buyer wasn't willing to counter or entertain counters. And so I talked to the sellers, and they were just like, yeah, we're gonna pass on this offer. We're not interested in accepting it. Well, I didn't right away. I needed, you know, a little bit of time in order to get back with the seller and discuss a few other things with them. And then as far as the buyer's agent was concerned, I wasn't in front of my computer to immediately, send them an offer rejection. It was also late at night. And so I was kind of already done with paperwork and whatnot. Well, but then before I was able to send the offer rejection, I got another offer from another agent. And before they sent the offer, they called me and they were just like, hey, do you have any other offers on the table? Well, even though I'd gotten instructions from my clients that they said that they probably weren't going to accept the offer, I didn't have anything in writing from them yet that said that. And I hadn't sent anything in writing yet back to the other agent, hadn't discussed anything with the other agent yet. So nothing I was doing was unethical. So the honest thing for me to say to that agent was that, yes, we did have another offer. And had she asked, is the seller going to accept it? Are they going to reject it? How are they going to respond to the offer? Then I would have had to figure out how I was going to respond to that in an honest and ethical way. Obviously, we have to be honest. We have to be ethical. This agent did not ask me those questions. Instead, you know, tried to get as much information, you know, tried to figure out how much the offer was for, tried to figure out, you know, tried to feel me out. And basically, I was just like, I don't have permission from the sellers to reveal this information, which I didn't. And if you guys know, in a multiple offer situation, you do have to get the seller's permission to reveal that sort of information. Otherwise, you are not representing your seller well. And so, long story short, is we went back and forth a lot of, you know, doing a lot of different things. And this person eventually did send me an offer. And the offer was for quite a bit above what the home was listed for. So we went from an offer that was well below what the home was listed for. I used that offer in order to negotiate an offer that was substantially higher than what the home had been listed for. So that's one thing. I got a big kick out of that, okay? I'm not going to get paid that much more for getting my client that much more money. And it's substantial. We're talking about over $20,000. More that they'll be getting versus if they had accepted the initial offer. That doesn't translate to a huge additional commission to me, but it translates to a whole lot more satisfaction for me because I love being able to provide that value for a client. Additionally, and this one just happened recently, I had a situation where with another listing of mine, I had a buyer's agent send me an offer. And the offer was a little bit low. It wasn't too crazy low, but it was lower than what I felt like the seller should accept. I talked to the seller. It was lower than what they, really wanted to accept. But based on the pre-approval letter and some other things, I wasn't really sure if the buyer could actually go up very much on the price. And one thing, me as an agent, I'm always skeptical and always leery and not weary, but wary. That's a common thing. A lot of people will say I'm weary of something when they're actually wary of something. I'm always very wary of a buyer, particularly like a first-time home buyer, that is right at the max of their budget. Because guess what? in this market where we have these high interest rates, there's a lot of contracts falling through after, like almost right away. As soon as a buyer starts to see the numbers and starts to see what their monthly payment will be, just back out right away during their due diligence period. That's one of the things that has happened as this market has settled. It's unfortunate, but people get that sticker shock when they finally realize, oh my gosh, I'm going to have to pay $2,000 a month for this house, or $2,500 a month for this house, or whatever the case may be. I was nervous about that. And I wanted to kind of feel that one out without revealing my hand that my clients were interested in countering. And so I went back to the agent to discuss several questions that I had. And then at the end, I said, you know, one of the concerns that I have here is that it seems like, based on the pre-approval letter and some other things, that maybe the buyer is purchasing right at the top of their price point with this offer that you've made. So I just want to double check on that. Now, remember, the offer that we have in hand is less than the counter that most likely the sellers are going to make, right? I hadn't confirmed the counter yet. I was getting this information from the buyer's agent first, before we actually made a formal counter. But I wanted to not just see, I wasn't even sure if they could afford the offer that they made. So I needed to confirm that, but I also wanted to confirm if they could afford more than that, without actually asking it, right? If I went to the agent, I was like, hey, the seller is going to counter this. They want more money. Can your client afford it? That puts that agent in a situation where she might be revealing information that is basically confidential to her client. So I had to ask it a different way. And the way I asked it was expressing a concern, which was also not a lie. It was a genuine concern that they actually couldn't afford even the offer that they had made. And when I asked that question, I got precisely the answer I wanted, and that was, oh yeah, they can afford $30,000 to $40,000 more than this. They've been looking at other homes a lot more expensive than this. It's just that they feel more comfortable closer to this price point. Bingo. That gave me the information that I needed without me even having to ask the question that I was really thinking in the back of my head. So that is the type of creative negotiations that are back. And I thrive in this sort of a market, so I'm very excited to see that happening. Okay, moving along. I spent more time on that than I thought I would. So moving right along here. Active inventory. We got to talk about that for a second. Active inventory, I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time here because we've talked about it before, but I want to consolidate a lot of things into this podcast. Active inventory is the highest it's been in basically 5 years. So buyers, when they're looking, they have more options on the market right now than what they've had in approximately 5 years. Now, does that mean that there's a lot of good options? No, there's still not a lot of great options. It's still a low inventory environment, but buyers have way, way more options than they've had in a long time. That's generally a very good thing, right? Obviously, if you're a seller and if you're selling a difficult home to sell, not a good thing. But if you're a buyer, and a lot of sellers are also buyers, it's a good thing in that instance. Let's talk about rates for a second, which we've talked about a good bit, but we've had some movement lately. So rates started to go back up in the first quarter of this year, which we discussed. I had a bad prediction at the end of last year that rates would stay below 7% on Mortgage News Daily for the entire year. That didn't happen. They went up in the first quarter because the inflation data, the jobs data, the wage data, everything came in hotter than expected. And so the expectation of the Fed cutting rates that was priced in to the market, that ended up going away when all this data came in hot and the Fed started saying, we're not going to lower rates anytime soon. So that pushed mortgage rates to be priced higher than what they had been, but they've come back down a little after some data that's come out this month has showed that things are actually cooling off a bit. So some of this inflation, jobs, wage data has started to cool off a little bit. And it's cooled off, honestly, a lot in since, 2021? So it's not like it hasn't cooled off at all during that time. but we kind of reached a point where it was kind of stagnating, where we weren't seeing a whole lot of movement in the inflation data. Well, we finally got a little bit of movement this month. That helped. So now we have seen mortgage rates come down just a little bit. And I'll mention as well that most of the high inflation data right now is being driven by shelter and insurance inflation, homeowners insurance, auto insurance inflation. And so really the core, when people think about inflation, right, going to the grocery store, going to, you know, the clothing stores or whatever, and seeing prices a lot higher, going to fast food, seeing prices a whole lot higher, in those markets, in those parts of the economy, the inflation data has really, really moderated, okay? Right now, the high inflation is being driven by shelter and insurance for the most part. And so really, the inflation data isn't as bad as it appears if you're just looking at headline numbers. And so all of that has contributed to mortgage rates. Not, you know, they've tapered off a little bit from the high that they hit a few weeks ago. Now, I just want to be clear on this because someone on Facebook called me out on this, which was kind of silly. It was more of a troll, in my opinion, than anything, because I put that we had the biggest one-day drop in mortgage rates in the entire year this past week. Now, that doesn't mean that they didn't drop from 7.5% to 6.5%. That doesn't happen. They dropped from, it was like from maybe 7.11 to 6.99, something like that. Well, that was the biggest drop of the entire year, the biggest drop since December, I believe, if I remember correctly, of last year. Nothing was inaccurate about what I said, but a loan officer who likes to troll some of my posts whenever I talk about mortgages, this loan officer wanted to point out that actually rates have not dropped, right? The Fed has not dropped rates. Accurate. It's the pricing of mortgage rates that has improved as a result of these market forces that I've already described. So just to be clear, the Fed has not dropped rates. Mortgage rates have dropped as a result of market forces, but they haven't dropped tremendously, right? They're still in that 7% range right now. Now, as far as the Fed is concerned, they're expected to drop rates later this year, but not by much. We maybe will see a September, 0.25, 25 basis point drop. We might see another rate drop before the end of the year. Maybe we'll get to 50 basis points. I'm not expecting there to be, at this stage, based on what the Fed is saying, a ton of dropping of the Fed benchmark rates, which would then impact mortgage rates, as a byproduct. Here's something that's interesting. Moving on to my fourth thing that I'm noticing here is the foreclosures and short sales are back. Now, before you get really excited, right, if you're an investor or a buyer that is like, oh, foreclosures and short sales are back. Yeah, they're back, but they're not back a whole lot, right? I've shown a couple of them the past few months. We haven't seen a ton of them, but in comparison to the past few years where we saw none of them, we're seeing a lot more than we've seen in a long time. Now, what's interesting, some people are gonna hear that probably, and what they'll hear is, oh, the economy's turning, the housing market's crashing. I'm not ready to say that yet, because the foreclosures and short sales that I'm seeing right now are not from people that have purchased the past few years in this higher interest rate environment. Now, it's very possible in the next few years we'll see a bunch of foreclosures from them as well. Time will tell. But right now, the foreclosures and short sales that we're seeing are being driven by investors that didn't know what they were doing, that got in over their head, trying to become a real estate investor, flipping their first house, that sort of thing. I'm seeing foreclosures on that front or short sales on that front. I'm also seeing it on the front of the older population or people not in good health that are just normal owner occupants who have owned a home for a really, really long time and don't have the higher mortgage rates. They're just not able to afford their mortgage anymore. And we might see this as the boomer population really starts to age. We're at a point where the older boomers, which I talked about a few episodes ago, are really starting to to get older. And sometimes what happens is they start to run out of money. And it is really sad when that happens, but they could find themselves in a situation where they're foreclosing. Sometimes they, are in a situation where they have been paying their mortgage manually, sending in a check every month, that sort of thing. And they get into bad health, end up, you know, in a hospital or in daycare or whatever, and stop making payments because their mind is somewhere else, right? They're dealing with health issues, dealing with issues with their mind as well. My dad, who passed away last year, you know, the last couple of months of his life, he was the one paying the bills. He stopped paying them and he had been paying bills his whole life. It was just at the end of his life, the mind just no longer prioritizes that sort of thing. And it's not even a consideration. You lose track of time. You're disoriented. And so those are the sorts of things that I'm seeing. And that is why I'm seeing, those are kind of the categories that I'm seeing these foreclosures and short sales, not a lot of them and nothing that I'm ready to draw major conclusions from at this point. But stay tuned. It's very possible that we could see more foreclosures and short sales coming back in the market. Again, like I said, right now, the people that have purchased with these higher rates, they are not getting foreclosed on yet. And I don't anticipate that happening because most of them have a ton of equity. But the people that maybe bought overspent in like 2022, for instance, they would be the most at risk. But we're only a couple of years removed from 2022. Most people don't foreclose that quickly. I mean, the foreclosure process itself usually takes a year or two. So like I said, we'll just have to keep track of that and see if that becomes more of a trend or if it just kind of stays on the trajectory that it's currently at. Hand in hand with this, and this is something that's exciting for me, I'm starting to see some retail either on MLS or off MLS with a realtor, which remember, we have a way of doing off MLS listings that are not pocket listings. They are called brokerage exclusive. So I'm with C. Dan Jordan Realtors. We're one of the largest, if not the largest real estate company in Greenville. And so people can list a home just with C. Dan Jordan Realtors. It doesn't go on the internet or anything. It is a retail listing. It's reported to the Greater Greenville Association of Realtors, the MLS, and all of that, but it just doesn't appear anywhere except for in C. Dan Joiner agents' email inboxes, and it can only be marketed to other C. Dan Joiner agents. Every company has the option of doing these brokerage exclusive listings. It's not just a C. Dan Joiner thing, but we just have a lot of agents, so we see this a lot more. So that combined with on MLS stuff, I am seeing properties coming on market. Retail market, we're not talking about wholesale. We're not talking about off-market, truly off-market kind of stuff. I'm seeing these things on the retail market that are flippable properties for the first time in 5 or 6 years. So that is a noteworthy trend, okay? Now, that doesn't mean that they're easy to get. The competition is fierce for these types of properties. So that's something to keep in mind. But that's great. I would love to see the market return back to a market where you see 1, 2, 3 properties come on MLS, heck, more if possible. That would be flip-worthy properties or properties that you could purchase and, you know, have some instant equity. Let's talk about multifamily for a second, right? You guys know, if you know me, if you've listened to this, I'm not a big multifamily specialist like apartment complexes and things like that, but I have always worked in the small multifamily space, the duplexes, the quads, small packages. I've got an 11-door package in Simpsonville right now. I have listed that's 4 buildings, 11 units, all on one plot, one plat. Right next to Simpsonville Elementary. If you're interested in that, let me know. I'll send you the information on it. But multifamily sellers right now, there's not a lot of multifamily on the market. Now, there's more than there has been, but there's still not a lot. But multifamily sellers still are not motivated, right? They're cash flowing. And if they don't get the price that they're looking for, they're simply not selling. It's that simple. So it's a challenging market, even though we're seeing some flippable properties come on the market, we're still not seeing a whole lot of major changes in the small multifamily space. We'll see if that changes, right? I've discussed before, a lot of these multifamily properties are on five-year loans. And so as those loans start to come to maturity, people have to refinance. All of a sudden, they might realize, well, I've got to double my interest payment, and the numbers might not pencil for them in the way that they were hoping that they would. So we might start to see at some point here in the next couple of years, multifamily come on the market and maybe have more motivated sellers. At the moment, most multifamily sellers that I'm communicating with, they are not what I would describe as motivated. They have a price. They want to get that price. If they don't get it, they're just going to sit on the property for a few more years and keep cash flowing and then maybe sell it in a few years for that price. And so that's something that we'll have to continue to keep tabs on. But the on-market multifamily segment, slim pickings at the moment. And if you're wanting to enter that space, you've got to be prepared to pay pretty close to, if not exactly, what the seller is asking for. Let's talk about due diligence for a second. So if you guys are active listeners of the show, you know, a couple of years ago, Greenville changed, and really the state of South Carolina. Well, let me back up for a second. All right, I got to explain this for those that don't know. So the South Carolina Association of Realtors produces real estate forms that every realtor in the state of South Carolina can use to do their real estate, basically all their real estate core paperwork, agreements between clients, seller's disclosures, purchase agreements, addendums, all of that sort of stuff. So the South Carolina Association of Realtors does this as a member benefit for every single realtor in South Carolina. Now, some local associations also have their own paperwork. Greenville doesn't. So Greenville is one of the markets, and Spartanburg is the same. Greenville, Spartanburg, Western Upstate is the same as well. Basically, the entire upstate of South Carolina, the uniform is that realtors use the what we call SCR 310, Form 310. That is the state purchase agreement that pretty much everyone uses when it's a retail real estate transaction. Well, a couple of years ago, there was a big change where we changed from repair procedure, which basically said that sellers needed to ensure that there were 9 categories of things that were in functional condition. But there was a lot of debate over interpreting those 9 things. It changed from that to a wide open-ended due diligence contract. And under due diligence, the contract is essentially, the way it was described to me by one of the top people with the South Carolina Association of Realtors, the contract is by default as is. A seller is not required to do any repairs at all. But the buyer can back out for any reason during their due diligence period. What is the thing that keeps the buyer from doing that? Well, they have to agree upfront to pay a termination fee if they back out. Now, it can be a $0 termination fee, but usually it's $500 to $1,000, sometimes more, sometimes less, just depending on the deal. Well, we've now had this system in place for 2 years. There was a lot of growing pains at the beginning. Some people didn't like it. But I think people have pretty much gotten used to it. But I heard someone complain to me recently that this due diligence system has flipped from being very seller-friendly in 2022 to now in 2024, it's very buyer-friendly. That was a complaint that I heard. And I just want to say, A, that's true, and B, that's exactly the way it works, because it doesn't take sides. It is just an open-ended way of doing it. And it mirrors the market. And I said this when this first came out. I told you guys were the first ones to hear this probably, that it was going to change whether it was buyer-friendly or seller-friendly based on the market. And in fact, the South Carolina Association of Realtors said this as well. When they trained us, they actually came to my office and they trained my office on this. And they asked people, do you think that this favors buyers? Some people raised their hand. Do you think this favors sellers? Other people raised their hands, and they then went to describe, it doesn't favor either, but it depends on the market. It doesn't inherently favor either, but it depends on the market. It could favor one party or the other. Right now, it is tilted a little bit in my opinion, towards favoring the buyers. Not a whole lot. It's not like buyers can ask for the moon and get that. But it is slightly favoring buyers right now. And sellers just have to stand their ground and understand what leverage they may or may not have. You know, if there is a repair that just has to be done, like I had a seller recently that while they were under contract, their AC went bad, the compressor went bad. And, you know, that's an expensive repair, and that's a frustrating thing to do when you're selling a home and, you know, your AC has been working fine and, you thought you were going to be able to get by with selling it and then it goes bad. That's really lousy. But in this market, you can't sell a home with a bad AC. And so they had to agree to fix that. But obviously, if buyers are coming in asking for a bunch of ticky-tack things, and if you have a home that, for instance, you got a ton of activity, maybe multiple offers on, you as a seller need to stand your ground and say, I don't need to do all these ticky-tack things. You need to weigh the moment and the environment and all of the data. And of course, me as a realtor, I help my clients assess all of these different things and determine how to approach the due diligence period and what repairs you agree to and what repairs you don't agree to based on that. But understand, it is a little bit more buyer-friendly, not dramatically, but a little bit more buyer-friendly on this front than it has been in the past. And that's just because buyers, again, they have more options than they've had. So they're a little bit more confident that if this contract falls through, they're going to be able to find something else. Stark contrast from 2021, when the market was at its craziest point, when buyers were having to waive repairs, say, we won't make any repairs, or if we back out, we'll pay $10,000 to the seller. Things like that were happening. That was a crazy environment. That was extremely seller friendly. It has definitely swung from that to being more buyer friendly, but it's not as dramatic as it could be. Now, if we go into a true full blown buyer's market, which I'm going to discuss here in a second. Then we could see it where buyers are really, really asking for the moon and maybe can get it. Okay. But we're not there yet. And it's going to be a while. If we get there, it's going to be a while before we get there. Now, while we're talking about buyers, I will mention that, buyers in general are just taking a long time making up their mind and quite frankly are being a bit difficult in negotiations. Like almost no buyer is offering a full price offer right now, even on homes that have just came on the market. I was just talking to a buyer's agent that made an offer on a listing that I had, and it was a lowball offer. And her explanation, you know, she sent me a single comp, and the comp was nothing comparable at all, right? There was like two things about this comp that were similar to the house that I had listed. And I told her, I was, you know, I just called it out. I was just like, this is not a comparable property. And here's why. I mean, I gave a list of like 10 things that were not comparable about the property. And I think she knows. I don't really know why she even was arguing with me. But it didn't matter. I got the house under contract for substantially more for, how much more? For $45,000 more than what her client was offering anyway. So my price was, you know, what I believe the price that house was worth was a lot closer than what she believed based on her one comp. But this is what we are running into with buyers and buyers agents. They're taking a really long time. Buyers are not in a rush. You know, it's like, well, maybe something else will come on the market. You know, this house checks off maybe, you know, 6 of my 10 boxes. Can I get to 7 or 8 boxes checked off? And then, like I said, being difficult in negotiations. This is market wide. And I think that this is contributing to, you know, I'm hearing realtors saying that they feel like the busy season has been slow for them. It's not been slow for me, but I'm suspecting that what they're feeling, and I have felt this, is this very dynamic that buyers are not super motivated. They're willing to take their time. They're willing to see what happens in the market. They're willing to see what happens with rates. Or they're just willing to take longer and rent longer, or whatever the case may be, than buyers have for the past 4 years. And that's something, you know, if you're a buyer or seller, that's something to keep in mind as you go through the buying or selling process. Here's one that I hoped I wouldn't have to say, but I have to say it anyway. And that is that low appraisals are once again a concern as appraisers start considering the way the market is shifting. Yes, I have not yet had a low appraisal, but I'm sweating out a few of them. We'll see. But I know several agents that have had low appraisals this year. Some really, really low, frustratingly low, this year and even going back into last year. And that's something that we really need to monitor, because appraisers are going to be looking at the past 12 months and figuring out, okay, and really they want to look at the past 6 months, but they'll look back usually at the past 12 months. And if they see that the trajectory of the market is bad, they're going to ding a house on the basis of that. And so they have a report. I went through this with you guys a few months ago, the market conditions addendum report. They will look at that. And if they see that the market is a decreasing median price point, depending on the type of loan that the buyer is getting, that could weigh into how they appraise a house. And so be on the lookout. Low appraisals are something that we have to be wary, not weary, although they do make me weary as well. We need to be wary about low appraisals yet again. It's been a minute. Appraisers have I feel like, done a pretty good job. At least the appraisers that have worked on my files the past few years have done a really good job keeping up with the market. And I'm not saying that, you know, I don't want this to sound like when there's a low appraisal that it's the appraiser's fault. You shouldn't have done it low. That's a bad appraisal. Not every low appraisal is a bad appraisal. But it's just something to keep tabs on, that it is, as we've discussed on this show before, a bit of an art, not strictly a science. So one appraiser will appraise something at full price. Another appraiser will appraise it $30,000 below what it's under contract or what it's listed for. And so that arbitrariness that is just a part of the appraisal world and the appraisal industry, that causes it to become, things become more prone to low appraisals when we have an environment like this where, you know, things are a little bit iffy, right? Some areas are not doing as well. I mean, we talked about Lawrence, South Carolina, you know, a few weeks ago, that's a market that could see a little bit of depressed demand here in the upcoming months and years, and we've already started to see that. Not every home in Lawrence. Again, you've got to understand that what's happening on a meta level doesn't necessarily apply to every single home. But when an appraiser is looking at things, they're looking at things from a meta level, and so that can impact the way they approach it, and result in low appraisals at the end of the day. Now let's address the question that I keep getting and or keep hearing people make an opinion on, and that is it a seller's market or a buyer's market? I still contend, as someone that approaches this from the perspective of doing this from a living now for 8.5 years, having been a real estate investor prior to that, so having seen market fluctuations, you know, I would even say I've been following the market very, very closely since 2009 when I was a first-time home buyer. That was really what got me interested in real estate to begin with. So from that standpoint, 15 years of data, this is very much still a seller's market from that perspective. But from the perspective and the standpoint of people who purchased real estate within the past 4 to 5 years and who are now selling, it doesn't feel that way. It feels like a buyer's market. And I hear that over and over again from sellers, even sellers who are selling for dramatically more than what they bought their home for just a few years ago. Even in their mind, it feels like a seller's market because it's so ingrained in their mind just how intense it was when they bought just a few years ago. And now they're seeing it is not that intense anymore. The market, say what you want, but it's definitely not as crazy of a seller's market. But just because it's not the craziest seller's market in the history of seller's markets, which is what it was between mid-2020 and mid-2022, that's not the measuring stick. So just because it's not the extreme seller's market doesn't mean it's a buyer's market, in my opinion. So I believe what we've done is we've moderated that seller's market. We've gone from the most extreme seller's market in the history of real estate to a very, very moderate market that is close to a flat market, right? Neither a buyer's nor seller's market. But to me, the dial is still turned towards the sellers in that they're still getting 98 to 99% of what they have a home listed for. It's still going under contract within 2 months. Inventory is still on the lower end of the spectrum historically. So all of these things add up together to me and tell me that it's still a seller's market, even if recency bias makes some people believe that it is a buyer's market. All right, this has gone on long enough. Let's look ahead for just 1 second and let's talk about what will impact the market in the month of August, and that is the what we've talked a few times since the National Association of Realtors had this compensation settlement that they did. Now, buyer agent compensation is not going away, unlike what the headlines say by the deceptive news media. What is going away is the offers of compensation in the multiple listing service, in MLS. Now, that means a few different things, right? You can still offer compensation. If I'm listing a home, I'm a listing agent, I can still offer to split my commission with a buyer's agent. And that is still what I intend to do because I still see the value in buyer's agents. But I have to advertise that in different ways. We're still figuring out exactly how that's going to be advertised. So like, for instance, it could be on the real estate sign, right, that you put in the front yard. It could say on there, you know, X commission. Three oranges. I'm offering a commission of 4 oranges to whoever buys this house, right? We're not supposed to say percentages. That's a mistake I've made in the past. Not going to say any percentages or any amounts. We'll just go with the theoretical as if we get compensated by with oranges. So I could put on my sign writer, I could put offering 4 oranges to a buyer's agent. I could put on my personal website, as long as there's not a real estate, what we call an IDX feed, to that's coming from an MLS, I can put it on my website. I can communicate it over the phone, via text message. I can communicate it via email. There's a lot of ways that I can communicate compensation. But what's going to happen is, I suspect probably a lot of agents won't even call and ask what compensation is once these changes go into effect. It's now going to be mid-August. I suspect that so we have a compensation form that the State Association of Realtors provides to all South Carolina realtors. It's been in there for years, right? And this form is typically used for sale by owner transactions, or perhaps if you're a realtor out of market. So for instance, let's say you're a North Carolina agent. You're not licensed in South Carolina, but you have a client that wants to use you in South Carolina. I misspoke. You are licensed in South Carolina, but this market isn't your primary market, and maybe you're not a part of the Greenville MLS, for instance. Maybe you're a part of the Columbia MLS, whatever that one's called. And if you're not a part of the MLS, you have to have a compensation agreement signed between the listing agent and the buyer's agent, and or the buyer's agent and the seller, showing having your compensation put in writing. What I suspect is that compensation agreement is just going to become a standard form that's just sent in with all offers. And we might not even have agents call up and ask, buyer's agents call up and ask the listing agent if they're offering any compensation. They're just going to go ahead and send that form along with the offer. And how does that impact things? Well, one thing's for sure, I don't think we can guarantee that it's going to mean commissions are going down in any meaningful way. I don't know. There's not going to be a way for us to track it anymore. So, we also won't be able to provide any data about it because none of that, will be trackable. So I'll have to, you know, come back on later, you know, maybe at the end of this year and anecdotally say what I have experienced with my listings after, you know, we've had a few months of the system in place after August. But we'll just have to see. But I don't think that, you know, the original changes, that when these changes were announced, I think we all kind of thought, okay, this is big. This is going to like radically change a lot of things. And now that I have gotten all the information, received all the information, talked to so many different people on the national and state and local level, the changes are not going to be as dramatic as you might expect for buyers and sellers of real estate. Now, the big one that we're not sure about yet is VA buyers. Currently, that is a big sticking point because this settlement really messes up the way the VA has their loan structure set up. So we're working with the VA to try to come up with a solution, and I'm pretty confident a solution will be provided for VA buyers because that VA program, they have a lot of smart people that have really improved that program over the years, and everyone wants the VA to get the full benefit of having served in our military. And so I think that that will work out. But the big question mark moving forward after August is how will the changes in how compensation are communicated and agreed upon, how will that change? Here's the interesting part, right? This compensation form I referenced, it can ask for either the listing agent or for the seller to compensate the buyer's agent. So that's going to be interesting, right? Let's say that the seller has agreed to compensate both the listing has agreed to compensate the listing agent with the understanding that the listing agent will then share their compensation with the buyer's agent. If a compensation agreement then comes over and says that the seller has to pay for the buyer agent commission, right, as opposed to the listing agent, now we've got to figure this out. Okay, well, what does that mean? Is the seller now double paying? Are they paying the commission? Obviously, if I'm representing the seller, they're not going to be double paying any commissions. But there's going to be some growing pains the second half of this year, okay? I told you guys this when we went through the due diligence contract in 2022. When that changed, I said, there's going to be growing pains. And sure enough, there were. It's going to be the same thing when this all changes in August with regard to buyer agent compensation. We're going to have growing pains, but we got through it in due diligence. And guess what? In my opinion, we're better off for it. And I genuinely believe we will be better off for this as well. Once this all gets finalized, I didn't like it at first. Now that I've gotten all this information, all this education on it, I kind of like it. I kind of like it. That it's going to make compensation in a lot of ways clearer, and it's going to make it, you know, less focused on what's happening in MLS, and it's just going to, I think, make it cleaner. We'll see. I might be wrong about that. It's going to create more work for realtors, but that's fine. We can work harder. That's not the worst thing in the world. And at some point, I'm sure there will be a technological solution off MLS that allows us to be able to find these offers of compensation in easier ways than us just having to call and text, you know, listing agents to see what the deal is. So that's TBD, but I wanted to bring it up because that's really the biggest thing that I can't discuss in this episode, but that we will be discussing in future episodes as far as how the market is settling out. So that's all I have for you guys for this week's episode. Thank you so much for watching or listening. If you like this content, please like, rate, review, subscribe, comment, all of those good things. By the way, I would like to do a Q&A episode soon. So if you have Q&A questions that you would like answered, please send those to me. You can send those to me via my contact information in the show notes. As well as if you need a realtor, that's also where you go. If you need a realtor in South Carolina, in Greenville specifically, find my contact information there. But you can shoot me a Q&A that way, or if you comment on YouTube, I will see it on there. If you have a question in there, I might even pull up some past questions that I've gotten and bring those in. I'm not sure when the Q&A episode is going to happen. I need to see how many responses I get. I'd like to have at least 10 questions. So please send those in. It could be anything about the local real estate market, perhaps even the national real estate market, mortgage rates, anything pertaining to that. Or if you have questions about me personally, right? if you want to send me a silly question, the worst thing I can do is say, no, I'm not going to include that on the show, but I'm not going to take it personally if you guys choose to do that. So thank you guys for listening. I appreciate all of you guys. Like I said, like, rate, review, subscribe, contact information in the show notes, and we will talk again next time.